Guys, this is Uriah Faber, the California Kid, here with Greg Conley, serial entrepreneur, founder of Trifecta Nutrition. We're talking about everything under the sun, fitness, entertainment, and of course, business, making that money. All right, we're back with another awesome guest. And, I've had a chance to spend a lot of time with Coach Lee Kemp and just getting to know, you know, you guys are just getting to know each other. But, I mean, this is going to be a very interesting interview for those that don't know about Lee Kemp, one of the most decorated athletes and definitely wrestlers in the history of the U.S. I think probably one of four or five in the history of our country to accomplish things and be awarded like he is. And that's a big statement because of the power and the history of wrestling. Wrestling is one of the most difficult, longest standing sports on the planet, and to be a guy that's considered a world champion, not only just a world champion, we'll get into that, but then an Olympic coach and the things that you're able to accomplish is pretty amazing. But your story is super interesting. I mean, and Greg, you're going to find out also, you know, when we get to know Lee a little bit, the mental game of this guy is incredible, which is important in business and sport and life in general. And people skills and things like that, but the commitment level is what is most impressive to me when I talk about Lee Kemp, and then the story behind how you're brought up from the womb to, you know, new families, new names, and to, you know, a chance meeting that inspired you to becoming one of the standout athletes in the history of our country. That's an exciting thing, and I'm excited to hear about a lot of the stuff you've got going on. I know we've got, you know, books and some of your accomplishments, and there's a big documentary that's about to come out. He's also just joined the coaching staff at Ultimate Fitness as a team leader for Team Alpha Male, as a coach for the athletes, and also mentoring in business because he's a business owner as well. So without further ado, welcome Lee Kemp to the show.
Thanks, Uriah.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Thanks for coming in today. And why don't you just get us started a little bit on you know, some of your accomplishments. Like for the layman's guy at home, what did you do in the sport of wrestling? Actual, you know, this is not opinion or bragging. This is like what actually happened. So why don't you break that down for us?
Well, I'll first.
He's like, I don't know how much time we have for this.
You know, it's. I'll just start by saying, you know, you really have to take a different perspective when there's a movie being made about you. You know, I'll just say that it wasn't my idea. I'll just say that I was flattered by it. But now that I've gotten into the process, I've had to talk a lot about myself, and not all of it's great. You know, a documentary's delve into parts of your life that aren't so good, you know, and that's what makes them interesting. The director wanted to go in those areas, and I was like, no, I don't want to talk about that. He says, no, this is a documentary.
That's what matters.
So I've gotten used to talking about myself. So to Uriah's question, I guess from the wrestling standpoint, I guess the most significant thing I've done is I was America's first three-time world champion. And that's significant to me because an athlete or anything you do in life, you want to be, you know, remembered for something, what your legacy kind of is. And when I was maybe getting onto our national team back after college, there had only been two world championships ever won by any American, just only two. I think we had Americans that could have won a lot more in my era, Gable being one of them. He retired at 23 years old. Just think about that for
that's
a second.
That's crazy. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so
early. And those who don't know who Dan Gable is, Dan Gable was the name in United States wrestling for the longest time. Went the entire Olympic Games without having a point scored against him, which is incredible. And, you know, had accolades from here to Mississippi. So we'll get more into that.
Yeah, that's Gable was my mentor. You know, whether he knew it or not, I was saw him as a person that was my mentor. But when I, finally realized I could probably win a world medal, my goal was to win as many as I could. I want to be greedy, I guess. John Smith kind of trumped that by doubling what I did. But anyway, when I was competing, there hadn't been more than two world championships, and that was only done by an Olympics and a world championship. Like Gable won the world championship in 1971, won the Olympics in 72, and retired. That's the Olympics is still a world championship, so that's two.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Americans that equaled that. Like Wayne Wells won an Olympic championship and a world championship. You know, there's been others. So to win three, I was the first. And so I guess
and
I'm
also the youngest, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah, when I won my first world championship in 1978, I was 21 years old.
Jeez.
And I was the youngest American to ever win a world championship. And until Kyle Snyder won a world championship in the 2016 world championship. So I don't know, over 30 years, whatever that works out to
long
be.
Long time.
And Henry Cejudo, though, won an Olympic Games, which is a world championship as well. He did it 8 years earlier in 2008.
And you were the coach of that Olympic
team. Yeah, I was the coach of that team.
Mm-hmm.
So,
pretty cool.
So for 30 years, I guess I was the youngest. So I always felt that I had finally done something that was going to be sort of remembered, because to win a national title, there have been national champions. To win three national titles, there's a whole bunch of those. My goal when I entered college was to win it four times, because no one had ever won it four times. That was my goal when I entered college in 1974, and I took second as a freshman. So right when I took second, I was like,
reassess your goals.
Yes, I'm not going to be the first anymore. So then the goal became, well, I better try to win three in a row if I can. And I'm talking like this is easy. I don't want you to think that I'm arrogant or think I was that easy. It wasn't. It was tough. There was times when there's times you always think you can't win. Just because you won it once doesn't mean you're going to win it again and again. It just each year is a new year. Those are the two main areas of wrestling: college wrestling and international wrestling. That's all we really have. There was no mixed martial arts, no MMA, UFC, none of that stuff. Obviously, that's recent.
Mm-hmm. Didn't even exist.
Didn't
back
exist.
Then.
Yeah. Even thought about.
That's kind of cool. Okay, so without getting too into the weeds on all the different titles, national championships, NCAA Division I wrestling championships. To put it in perspective for some of you MMA fans out there, I was top 12 in the nation one time. That was the best I had done. Daniel Cormier won it a couple times.
He took second to Cale Sanderson.
He took second to Cale Sanderson. Chad Mendes took second. Henry Cejudo never competed in the NCAA.
In college, no, he didn't. He wrestle
straight
in college.
For the Olympics. Yeah. So, that's pretty impressive as far as, you know, as anything goes.
Yeah.
In the sport of wrestling, then you be the youngest winner of a world championship. Then you do it three times, and then you make leaps and bounds internationally on other things. There's also an unfortunate thing that happened, which is the Olympics being canceled in the 80s. And there's a guy named Dave Schultz. There's a movie called Foxcatcher out. If you haven't seen Foxcatcher, Dave Schultz is kind of an iconic guy in wrestling. And he, you know, had this tragic stalker dude that was like a DuPont. What was the guy's name? Who was a wealthy man that shot him.
Mm-hmm.
Had like a weird obsession with him and ended up killing him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a legendary wrestler as well, so a lot of people know him. And that's someone that Lee had to wrestle. Lee wrestled him, what,
14 times.
14 times, oh, wow. Beat him 9 times in a row. And, you know, this is like iconic stuff that's happening in the world of wrestling. So that in itself is pretty impressive on the wrestling front. Had to be disappointing with the Olympics getting canceled.
Devastating. I'm still bummed out about it, really. Yeah. I mean, and I've got to get over it. Sometimes close people, friends,
laces
say,
out.
They say, Lee, get over it. Get over it. No, I'm not. I want to still pout about it. I think about it,
that was kind of the moment that made you shift. It's weird because in the wrestling world and the fight world, and I'm one of the guys in the fight world that's sticking around and bring on the next generation and still being involved, et cetera, and having a presence. Lee kind of got some backlash and just stepped away from the sport. But that had to be a little bit of having a bad taste in your mouth from that Olympic opportunity just being smashed and then just saying, you know what, screw it, and moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then you went into the straight into the business world, right?
Yeah, I did. I ran from it. What I learned, though, is sometimes in life, you don't always get what you want. You don't always get what you worked for. You don't always get what you deserve. Life isn't fair. I mean, you can go down that road thinking things weren't fair. I mean, in fact, I jokingly said to some close friends when I was training for 1980, I was so confident. I was so confident. I said once jokingly, the only way I wouldn't win the Olympics in 80 is if they cancel the games. And I was like,
you jinxed it.
I jinxed it for the whole world.
Yeah, knock on wood. Come on now.
But every athlete in that zone feels like that. John Smith, I know him. He just felt that no one could beat him, you know, and that's why he won 6 consecutive world titles. That's how confident I was. I mean, I just, and then when it didn't happen, it was beyond devastating. It was just, so I still can't even comprehend that happening today in our society. And not just me. I mean, there's 400 or 500 American athletes.
Yeah, I know a couple of the guys. Coach Azevedo.
Hey, he was on that team.
And he's a good friend of mine, and he was the guy that got snuffed. And I think Joe Gonzalez. He was another guy that didn't make it happen. But, you know, sometimes, you know, that kind of stuff, that's the same with me. I've got a little thing. Everyone's always, like, talking to me about not having the UFC championship. And the UFC championship was not an option for me because the lightest weight class was 170 pounds. And the UFC owned the WEC. And so people are always like, oh, what is it? Is it kill you not to have the UFC championship? It's only because of miseducation and, you know, the way the thing worked out. But I wasn't able to come into the UFC until I was 32 years old. And I was a world champion when I was, you know, mid-20s. And then I just kept on trying, you know, try after try after try. I get right there and earning spots because no one could beat me to get there. And then I'd have, you know, miss it by a decision or whatnot. But still, it's like something that comes up all the time for me. Well, what about the UFC belt? And I'm like, hey, I tried. You know, I mean, and I can say it with a proud, like, clear conscience that I was one of the guys that never cheated, did the PEDs, and this just lived a healthy life and worked hard and believed in myself. And I was at the top for 12 years, but it is still like a little bit of a like, hey, you did all this, but what about that belt? And I'm like, I mean, it's something where the naysayers can always just dig on you a little bit. But at the end of the day, I mean, life happens, you know. You got to be pretty proud about what you've accomplished, and then you take those lessons into the next era of becoming a businessman. Before that,
let me just add something. Hearing you say that, and I've heard that for the first time, it's very similar to me not being able to say I'm an Olympic champion.
Right.
I've been around people, some of our Olympic champions, I'm not going to mention any names, but and they'll start talking amongst themselves, you know, being proud, and they should, being Olympic champions. And they might want to take a photograph. Say if we had a function where, you know, a lot of our past and present champions, let's get a picture of all us Olympic champions. And I'm standing with everybody like.
That's 1% 1% elite problems. Dang.
I know.
He's like, I'm like, just a world champion.
Would all the world champions, multiple world champion record holders stand over there and all the Olympic gold medalists
stand over here. So when someone jabs you, hey, what about the UFC?
Yeah.
And someone says, well, what about the Olympics? Same thing. You won the Worlds. Well, how'd you do in the Olympics?
Yeah.
And okay, the boycott's one thing. Well, didn't you try in 84? Yeah, I got beat, though. I didn't make the team. Schultz beat me. So I got to say that.
Schultz, who he beat 9 times. You know, and then it's the same thing with me. Like, they have these fake belts now all the time. And people always, at signings, they always want, they have the fake belt, and then people want to hold the belt, and people want me to hold the belt. And I'm like, I'm not holding that belt.
Mm-hmm.
It's like him holding the Olympic gold medal and being like, you know, so it's, and I'm like, nah, I'm not going to touch the belt, which is kind of weird. I shouldn't feel that way, but I just have to. I mean, I can't like hold the belt, you know. I just, you know, I It's a weird kind of feeling.
It's funny you think that way because in your UFC Hall of Fame video, they announce you as 4-time defending champion. You know?
Yeah.
But well, you know, because they think of it that way. I mean, it's like you were the champion in mixed martial arts and there were a bunch of different
leagues. And it was owned by the UFC. I mean, I was still reporting to Dana White and Joe, Sean Shelby and Joe were doing the matchmaking and it's exactly the same company.
Just different weight classes.
But they didn't give us because they were trying to monopolize TV markets and monopolize sponsorships and you know, money based things. So they're, you know, having two big shows that they own. One had the lightweight fighters and the other one's here. And I helped them build the market to where they finally put them together. But I was 32 at the time and one of the situations. So, you know, that being said, it's always like, you know, it's kind of a weird question that's asked, but it's a real thing, you know. Hall of Famer, sure, you know, world champion, sure, but a UFC champion, you can't, it's not on the credentials. So I can relate to that. What I thought was most interesting about what you said going into this is when you went into college, you want to be the first time four-time champion, and you started wrestling kind of late.
Yeah, I started in ninth grade.
Ninth grade.
I didn't make the varsity till 10th grade year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that is crazy because Chad Mendez, Lance Palmer, DC. I don't know about DC's story actually, but a lot of these guys start when they're 4 or 5 years old and they work towards it, et cetera. I got kind of a late start in wrestling. I know Lee did. Mark Munoz is the guy that kind of got a late start and became a national champion also. But the idea of just thinking big like that, especially after you only wrestled for 4 years, and you're like, I want to go in to this established, the oldest sport in the world at the highest level, and I want to set an all-time record. I'm going to be really upset if I don't do it after 4 years competing in a sport is a crazy think big, like, mentality that not everybody has, but they can have if they just believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what separates a lot of people. And what I thought is interesting, because I hear you talk about it with the guys all the time on the team, is the moment where that became reality. And it was just a switch of the brain that you heard from somebody that has done things like that, and you knew he'd done it, and you believed it, and you just believed.
Yep.
So, and that was
meeting Dan Gable for the first time. It was after my 10th grade year in high school. I just had a 500 season, as you might expect. My first year on varsity, you know, I had 11 wins, 8 losses. We had ties in Ohio, so I had 3 ties on top of that. So if the ties would have been losses, I'd have been 500. That summer, I went to a wrestling camp, like every kid goes to camps, no matter what sport, but I went to a wrestling camp. That was the summer of 1972, the Olympic year. Dan Gable was there in his final stop of training before he went over to Munich to compete in the Olympic Games. And so I was just a camper there. I wrestled at 132 that year. And because he was bigger than life, really. I mean, it's hard to imagine for listeners now before the internet, but back then, you know, it was magazines. You had to read about people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a big spread.
I know. That's where we're like magazines.
Yes. And there was a big spread in Sports Illustrated on Dan Gable. I still have it. And it talked about him. And he had won the world championships in 1971. And he beat the Russians so convincingly that Russia owned the sport. And they didn't like the fact that an American was beating them. So they made a public announcement. And they said they were going to find a Russian to beat Dan in the 72 Olympics. So it became a big deal. So Dan had that added pressure of knowing that Russia was the best country in the world for wrestling, and they were going to find somewhere. And that wasn't just Russia. It was when all the republics of the former Soviet Union were all together in one. It was the USSR back then. So it was huge, huge. So all the various republics were all together, and they were going to find one person out of that republic to beat Dan Gable. Mm-hmm. Now all those republics are all broken up into their own countries, Russia being a separate country as well. But anyway, so, and we all knew that as campers. And Dan needed a drill partner to teach the technique. I was new, green. When I'm at clinics, I ask the campers, who do you think his drill partner was? And I'm kind of leading him on so some of them will get it. And they go, was that you? It was me. So just think about that for a second. Think of the times that you've been in a seminar or a workshop or even a technique class where you have an opportunity to step forward and to be maybe the drill partner or the demonstrator or something where you put yourself out there. Or let's say you're in an acting class and so you want to put yourself out there and just demonstrate that you can do it, or that you, it's like those shows where you show your talent or something.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I just didn't have any fear, even though, you know, I don't think I was very confident person. It was like everybody else, I wasn't, but I knew I wanted that thing that Dan Gable had. So I thought that if I could get close to him, near him, if he was touching him, drilling me, and just doing
some
the technique on me, yeah, that's what I thought, you know. And so anyway,
magic dust.
And that's how, and so for the whole week, when he was demonstrating all the technique, I was the drill partner. And I poked him in the eye once. He doesn't remember it. I was so awkward. I didn't know, you know, because as you know, when you teach anything involving another person, this, you know, they got to kind of know, mm-hmm. you know, when to move, when not to move, listen to your commands. And so I was just probably spastic, didn't know what to do. But anyway, so I went back from that camp wanting to be like Dan Gable. That meeting changed my whole thinking. And I tell people, did I find a Superman cape in my closet when I got home? And that'd been cool if I did, and I became a champion because I realized I had these superpowers. But I found out that my brain was the superpower. It that switch got flipped on, and nothing changed other than my attitude and my commitment level to wanting to be good.
You think it's just because you set your expectations so much higher?
Oh,
being
absolutely.
Someone like that?
Absolutely. In fact, I really admire a camper or a kid when I'm in a clinic that'll come up and ask me to drill or work out, or can you show me that, Coach Kemp, or something, especially when it's obvious that they're a kind of a beginner, because mm-hmm. that to me shows some confidence. I was that guy. And Dan taught the clinic because he was being paid to do that. But then after that, he worked out because he was going to be going to Munich in about 3 weeks or 4 weeks. So he had all of his training partners there. He had Ben and John Peterson, who also were Olympic medalists in that 72 games. Ben won a gold medal along with Dan. His coaches were there, his entourage, if you, that's the word we give it now.
Yeah.
But they were all there helping him train, you know? And so when the session was over, normally you go to lunch, right? It was too important for me to stay there and watch Dan train and work out than to go to lunch. So I missed lunch every day. I didn't care. I just sat and watched him work out with these guys. It was like,
that's crazy.
It was like watching Dan go with Ben Peterson, with John Peterson, with his Les Anderson. They were just, They were training hard. They were in their finals phases of training, and I got a glimpse of what high intensity training was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them to work out. Can we work out? No kid. I'm training for the Olympics.
But that's like Angie poked me in the eye.
holding a little grudge there. So that's kind of crazy. I mean, that's, you know, and this is something I noticed in Greg right away when I decided to get involved with Trifecta. For Lee, for you, you know now because you're eating Trifecta food also. But when I spoke with Greg, you know, the numbers were small. It was like 250,000 a month or something like that in sales, which is pretty good. Or I can't remember what the number was. But Greg's talking to me about how big this company could be. And he's talking about, like, yeah, I think we can be to a couple hundred million and probably do, you know, and we can get to a billion. You know, when somebody throws out the billion word,
you go, okay,
but confident, and it's not very, it takes a lot of confidence to say, I want to be a 4-time national champion, or I want to be a this, or I want to be a world champion. And that's a lesson that I learned from setting goals that weren't big enough for a mm-hmm. long time. I used to set goals. Like, I know for a fact, there's nobody that was working harder than I was in high school and in college for wrestling. There's no way. I was doing too much. Mm-hmm. And I had some physical gifts and I had a mentality and everything else. But the goals I was setting were just small. And that you need those small goals.
Safe,
they're like
safe goals.
Safe goals,
yeah, yeah.
To get
That's
there.
A good word for it.
But
yeah.
But you gotta eventually have the big goal, that there's the input goals, the things that you can do every day. You can get up at this time. You can eat at 2 eggs, you can do 20 push-ups, whatever it is. Those are tangible things you can mark off a list. Input, I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. And then there's the thing that you want. I want to be a 4-time national champion, set the world record. You can't always control that. As you know, you can't control the Olympic thing. The Olympics got canceled. You know, like there's things that you control. That's what I liked when I heard Greg talk, and I could tell, just like I can tell with an athlete that comes in, like a kid like Kaleo or a kid like Alexander Munoz or a kid like Song Yadong, these up and coming fighters, when they think they can do something, but they really, really, really mean it, there's an idea of I really know I can do this, and then you get knocked down, you get knocked down, you get knocked down. You either lose that, I think I can do this, and be like, oh, dose of reality. No, I can't. Never mind. Or you get up and it motivates you to keep going. And we've already, seeing the insights of the business there, had these little and some big business of adversity. But watching the company grow and hearing the vision from the get-go is something that was kind of inspiring to me. So I like that, you know, well, I always like to tie things back together because there's a recipe for winning. Right. And, you know, success. And I like the quote that you say, success is not an accident. What's this quote that you always say?
Oh, it talks about the rent. Quote.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you paid your rent today? Success is never owned. You never own success. It's never yours. Mm-hmm. It's rented on a daily basis. And unless you pay your rent, you have to leave. What happens if you don't pay your rent? You get evicted. You have to leave.
Yeah,
so does your success. Last year's accomplishments doesn't pay the bills now.
Yeah, right. You know? Absolutely. And I love that idea of like the big, business, they call it like a big audacious goal. But whether it's in business, wrestling, whatever it is, because when you know, I briefly mentioned expectations. Like, I'm a true believer that when you set that, whatever that goal is in your mind, and you've reset your expectations, suddenly it creates a huge sense of urgency. You know, mm-hmm. if you're like, holy shit, I want to be a national champion in the next 2 years, I got to be training all the time. Yeah. I got to be eating right. I got to surround myself with these amazing wrestlers and learn all these new techniques and everything. And it's the same in business. I'll talk to business owners that are like, I really want to get to 5 million in the next 3 years, and I'm like, okay, for a lot of people, 5 million seems like a lot of money. But if I'm sitting there going, okay, I want to be at a billion in the first 5 years, that means I've created a huge sense of urgency for myself.
Right.
I got to be by 5 million in the first year, 20 million by year three, about 250 million by year four, if I'm going to reach a billion by year five. So suddenly it really kind of resets your mindset where you're not like saying, okay, I'm making good progress towards whatever that smaller goal is, because the goal is so big, you deconstruct the goal backwards and go, wow, I got to make these big jumps in, wrestling technique or, sales or, whatever the situation is. And that's something I think
getting comfortable almost, I feel like.
Yeah. And it's something I think a lot of people miss because they, I love that you calling it a safe goal. They're like nervous about setting that big goal because they may fail and they don't realize.
Or even being vocal about it and saying it. Like,
yep.
How many people that like they want to do something? I'm like, did you ever tell anyone else? They don't want to tell anyone else because they don't want it. It's that safe. You don't say it. Speak up. You want to do something? Speak up. I like when you say we're going to do $1 billion. You may be full of crap. We're going to find out, but the way things are going, the business is growing. Everybody loves it. Big sponsor of the UFC, CrossFit Games, the list goes on of what's going on. And that's the same with Coach Kemp. And you were talking about wrestling camps and it just brought back so many memories. I got a late start also from my eighth grade year before I went into high school. I got kind of a wrestling bug. There was a little program, after school program, my junior high, and I went a couple times to practice, and I think I like did one tournament and researched and went to a tournament and to found a camp. And I ended up writing a letter to that camp and asking if I could work the camp in exchange for a week. So I went there and worked the camp in exchange for a week. And I remember being completely baffled. And then, you think about the fact that I'm getting a late start on this thing, and then you have guys that have been pushed by their parents since they're little kids, which is also, create some real success. Some of those guys I couldn't catch by the time I was done, but I remember being baffled that they had all these activities at the camp and kids kept on signing up, paying money. you could either do the session or you could go on the hike or you could go rafting or you could do this. And it was so weird to me that guys were at the camp and they were paying to go do these other things and missing practice. I just couldn't fathom it. It was just weird to me. And someone asked me if I wanted to go, and I was like, no, I'm here to wrestle. To wrestle.
Why are we here?
Like, this is a wrestling camp. Yeah, that kind of thing. And, I wonder how much of this, I'm a human development major at UC Davis. That was my thing. How much is nurture? How much is nature? Obviously, you're 61 years old and you can go with, a 20-year-old kid, no problem. And you've obviously taken care of yourself. I want to hear more about that. But the genetic thing is important, but a lot of it's learned as well. I've got to know Lee from the last, few months of him being at the gym and the team, and hearing his story with his documentary coming out is pretty cool. Like, why don't you give us kind of a little rundown of your original name and how that got changed and what that looked like. And kind of what that role was in becoming who you are today.
He's like, it was also Uriah. What are the odds of that?
What can I say?
Yeah. I can't remember.
Make it to a little story. My parents that adopted me told me I was adopted when I was, so it didn't bother me. I didn't really know quite what that meant. I just knew I was happy, so I didn't care. My parents said they wanted to tell me, so that some neighborhood kid didn't say, hey, you're adopted, because kids are mean to each other. Yeah. I was maybe six or seven or eight or whatever. My parents told me that. So anyway, now fast forward to, I'm married. I'm divorced now, but I was married. And my ex-wife wanted me to, she thought it would be good for me to find out who my birth parents were. She was a social worker, so she kind of understood how to do stuff like that, like get your birth certificate and all that stuff. So anyway, I just told her, yes. And so she did what she needed to do, and my birth certificate came in the mail, so it was there. And so I was excited. She said, your birth certificate is here. So and she looked at it, but she understood. She knew the process, basically. I looked at it and I'm like, oh, they sent me the wrong one. It's got somebody else's name on it. That was my thought. I go, this isn't mine. My name is Leroy Kemp, but it was Darnell Freeman on it. And it was like, wow, it just finally sunk in. Like, that's who I was. My mother named me Darnell Freeman. Her name is Barbara Freeman, and I have a relationship with her. And she had two other daughters, so those are my sisters. And one of my sisters had a son, my nephew. He's a wrestler. He was a pretty good wrestler. He made it to state in Ohio, but didn't know all that till I was like 36-ish, 36.
You met that whole side of the family.
Yeah, later
when
after.
You were 36.
Yeah, or let me tell you what. But right around then. So Darnell Freeman, that was just her side of the family. So then my ex-wife said, well, do you want me to find your dad too? And at that time I was like, yeah, go ahead.
So Darnell Freeman was your original name.
Yeah. So my birth certificate,
but you weren't adopted till the age of
I was five. I was in two foster homes, and I was probably, people don't like adopting kids who are much older than five. So I might have been stuck there for a long time. Mm-hmm. Might have been just sort of institutionalized in that care. I've known kids who were, for various reasons, they were just in a foster home till they graduated high school. When I was five, my parents adopting, they were older. They were in their 50. My mom couldn't have any kids, and she was one of like 11 children from the South. My dad was one of about 11 kids. There's a lot of children on both sides, but they themselves couldn't have any kids. Mm-hmm. Both, all their sisters and brothers had a lot of kids, but they couldn't. So they decided to adopt a child, and they were looking for an older child because my dad said that, and my mom didn't feel like they were at the age where they wanted to have an infant. So they wanted an adult, like a kid about my age.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that came. Yeah, it's kind of how that came about.
So being a human development major, you learn like 95% of what you'll learn in this world in the first 3 years. You are reactive to your name before you can talk or anything else. You know your name. Mm-hmm. And you're learning how to eat, how to walk, how to talk, how to do all these things by the age of three. Interactions and security, whether you're secure or not, and these kind of things. Before you're three, to change, just up and change your name at 5 years old, it's probably illegal now, I would think, in the adoption process.
It should be.
It should be. You can't just be like, you know what? your new name's Jerome, you know, and you're 5 years old and like, you know, that must've taken some getting used to. That's kind of trippy on its own. But, you know, then going back and meeting your family and didn't you say your mom actually had, to, it was on Christmas that you were born?
Yeah. Christmas Eve at night, Christmas Eve. And I learned that in the documentary because they interviewed Barbara, my biological mother. And I, you know, I watched the first cut of it, you know, it's not released yet, but it's close. And I watched some of her interview, and she said that it was Christmas Eve. I was born. And then she was told that they would take me right away. Cause she was 17, I think.
She already had a kid.
Yeah. She had a 2 year old at the time. Jeez. So, Darlene was her name, Darlene. And my mom might've been 18, but still she was under the, she knew that she wasn't going to get to keep me. And she said, for some reason, they let me stay with her for 2 days. So think about that as a mother. Golly, you have a child for, you just gave birth to for 2 days.
Yeah, and you get then, attached, yeah.
And then they come take the child away. And it was crushing. It was just hearing her talk about it in the documentary. And when I heard that, I called her and asked her about that. And she confirmed how tough it was. But I've had 3 kids of my own, and you're absolutely right, man. I used to tell a child that their name is different, and
that'd be so strange.
In my adoption records that came with me to my parents that adopted me, everywhere in there it lists that my name is Danny. So when you're in a foster home, I guess it's up to the person to call you whatever they want. You know, I guess
probably not now.
Yeah.
And that is quite a long time
ago.
Yeah,
so it's...
Man, that's crazy.
It references me as Danny all the way through the narrative.
So you were Darnell,
the
then Danny, then
And then Leroy, which I didn't like that name, Leroy, growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. It was always kind of like, you know, all those stupid songs. Like, yeah. Remember that song?
Leroy Brown, Leroy the baddest Brown. Man in the whole damn town. Meaner than a junkyard dog.
I got that all through high school. And then there was a song by Joe Tex. This goes back to the old, you know, Sam Cooke kind of days. He had this song called Leroy, You Got the Girl with the Skinny Legs. You should Google that, and you can hear that song probably on YouTube. I hated that song, so I'm a
you
child
got the
of
the
girl 60s.
With the skinny legs.
So I got teased by that all the time.
Oh, that's funny. So then you get your so then your wife says, hey, do you want to meet your dad? And so what does that process look like?
Well, she went ahead and the reason why she could find both of them so easily, they both were from very large families with a lot of boys. So the last name, the Freeman name, there was a lot of Freemans. After she saw the birth certificate, Barbara Freeman, and then my biological mother didn't know my dad really. It's just like a one night kind of a thing. She met this guy and his name was Theodore Mathis. So she wrote his name on the birth certificate and she wrote U.S. Army. Because he was from Cleveland, but he was in the Army. He was home on just a leave that he had. And they went out. They met or whatever. And then he was gone. He was gone for all those 38 years until I come knocking on his door. But so my ex-wife looked up all the Mathises in the Cleveland phone book and all the Freemans. And there was a bunch of them. So she just called them all.
So that's she crazy. Found,
she, found, she found a relative that – and she said they're all guarded, though. You know, like when she knew she was getting close, somebody was like, yeah, I kind of remember my sister had a child and she gave him up. I mean, stuff like that, conversations like that.
They're yeah. like, yeah, what is, trying not to get caught up yeah. in anything, probably, huh?
So the same thing on my dad's side. She called all the Mathises, and there were a lot of boys. There was like 11 children on both sides with a lot of boys, six boys. So, but when I found my biological father, that was a trip, boy. It was definitely a trip. Theodore Mathis, in fact, I took, it was in 1993, that's when my son was born. So he was born in like March, and then in May, we met Barbara and Theodore. So we took my son at the time. So he met Barbara and he met Theodore, but anyway, we're at the airport. He lived in Amityville, New York. So we were, you know, Cleveland or the, LaGuardia Airport, and we're just waiting. I'm just fidgeting. We had pictures we send back and forth, and then I see this guy come around a corner. He had a long black leather coat. Just think of the Mac. Think of something from that
like
era.
The pimps.
He just
the pimp of the year.
He just strolled out. He was kind of walking toward us.
Just strutting. I
mean, he looked cool though. And he's like, man, that's my dad right there. You know, and he had a brim on and he was walking toward us. I'm thinking, wow. You know, I mean, I grew up in Chardon, first of all. It was an all white community. My parents were black. I was born in Cleveland, a black environment, but then my parents wanted something different for their life. So mm-hmm. we moved, and it's during the 60s, during the turbulent time of the 60s. Martin Luther King's assassination, Bobby Kennedy, all that crazy stuff was going on throughout the whole United States. Mm-hmm. Watson, California, Cleveland, Detroit, you know, you name it. So they moved 30 miles to this farming community in Chardon, Ohio. So I was like one of two black kids in the whole junior high school. Oh, so wow. Go from Cleveland. And, you know, I saw a lot in Cleveland. You know, I was starting to be, you know, hang out and stuff. And then Chardon, which was so anyway. So country. So
you had a lot of time to practice.
And then I went
wrestling.
To college at Wisconsin, you know, University of Wisconsin. So everything kind of stayed in that world, and it's probably good because it was more of the real world mm-hmm. To be able to get along with both races, you know, really not just be so isolated, if you want to think of it that way. But anyway, so anyway, you know, we're out there in New York, and I see Theodore, and he's walking toward me, and it was like, you know, it just didn't seem to fit really, because my life was so different than what it appeared like his life was, you know? Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, you know, he was a working man. He worked hard and, you know, he was married, had three children in his marriage, but he had like four outside. So he really wasn't that good of a guy from that standpoint. You know, he had two children before he got married, and he was 18 when he got married, and I was one of them. And but anyway, you know,
you guys went and hung out and
yeah, I got to he took me to this. Well, right when he met me, first of all, you know, we you know, got to, you know each other a little bit, and then in the ride back to his house, and then we didn't even go in. You know, my ex-wife was in the car, you know, with my son Jordan at the time. He was an infant, and so everyone called Theodore Teddy. And Teddy said, hey, I wanna take you to, you know, introduce you to some of my friends. And so I'm like, okay. You know, I don't know what to say. So, you know, my wife, Linda, gets out of the car, and then he just takes off. And Linda goes, you just left me there. You know, I just met these people. You know? And you get off the car and you leave for hours. And, you know, the movie, The Barbershop, we've all seen that by yeah. now, right? He took me to this place, The Barbershop. Those places exist, obviously. And he takes me there. So one tip, when we drive up in front of it, you know, we're there. And it was, you know, springtime, you know, whatever, but it was still a nice day. So I had the windows down. So I was rolling the window up, you know, and he said, you don't have to do that. He said, no one's going to touch my car. He just gets out and walks away from the car. And he was a big, he was athletic looking. He looked like Jim Brown. He wasn't tall, but he was big.
Yeah.
Thick arms.
He was an imposing dude. He didn't feel like anyone was going to mess with his stuff.
No, he had a tank top on.
He was very confident no one was going to mess with his stuff.
That was Teddy, man. And so we go to the barbershop. And it's place. We go into the barbershop. Hey, Teddy. And then we go into the back of the barbershop. Everybody, you know, shooting dice and smoke. Just crazy. Mm-hmm. Just so those places exist.
Yeah. It was, that's kind of crazy to see. And that's what I think about, like, the nature versus nurture. I always bring it back to this, and I've mm-hmm. had discussions. I mean, really, what they say, take out religion and society and community and all that kind of stuff, and you've got animals, and there's, you know, dominant animals and less dominant animals. And if you look at, like, different, like, you know, the wolves and the gorillas and the bears and, like, there's certain type of birds, like, there's, like, procreation that happens. And sounds like this dude was kind of an alpha male that, you know, had, you know, in his own world, no one's going to mess with my car. He comes up strolling. He's got his he's got his brim hat on, and he's got his trench coat on, and, you know, he's got his family, but he's got four kids. One happens to be one of the most successful wrestlers of all time, and, you know, whatever else. And it's just kind of crazy when you think of, like, animals, like in the animal world.
Mm-hmm.
If it's about procreation for a woman, it would be find the biggest, baddest, and most intelligent person to be invested in you to procreate with and have him provide, protect, and watch out, right? And for a man, as an animal, it would be spread your seed in as many healthy women, and healthy is judged by symmetry. Like a sign of a good immune system is symmetry in the face and symmetry in the body. And there's other things like boobs are, you know, full of fat, which means they're healthy.
This podcast taking an interesting turn.
No, I'm serious. Like this is what I think about. Like all the time when I hear stories like this, I'm like, here's Lee Kemp, has no idea who his pops is, shows up and this guy has got the community on lock. You know, and then he goes and becomes the world champion and everything else. And there's got to be a little genetic play to that thing. But I mean, really, you know, in the animal world, survival of the which is how humans have survived on the planet, is procreation and instincts, etc. Is like you take the baddest dude, and it happens. I was on a hunting trip with Chad Mendez, who we're going to have in here soon, and we're talking about these animals, and this guy is telling me all these animal traits, the guy who owns this ranch, about this animal does that, and this animal will impregnate its daughter, and like this animal has, you know, a deformed one horn, so he keeps killing all the little babies with the one horn to make sure that the women go back into procreation.
Like,
and stuff.
I'm like, where are you going with this one?
No, I'm serious. So it's kind of a trip to me when you take out the fact that we're humans, and the thing that separates us is all the intelligent things we have, but there's still these animal instincts that are happening. And here's a guy that comes up on the guy that you know, gave him life, who, and they both happen to be in their own community surviving and thriving and doing that kind of thing. And, you know, for a man, it would be, if it was just about procreation, it would be getting as many healthy women as possible and provide, protect, and watch over the most valuable ones, or the ones that are the you know, whatever. That's kind of the way it would go. Like, and that happens with elk, that happens with monkeys, that happens with all these different things. And we're just humans, man. And I start thinking about that all the time when I, like, when you look at things like that, it gets weird. But
you stayed up way too late last night, didn't
you? I did, yeah. No, but I studied about this in school. We used to have to write papers on this type of stuff. Like, I did a paper about two communities, one Greek community where they survived by farming and the women had to farm, and one native Mayan community in Mexico. The Mayans are in Mexico. Yeah. And,
or Peru, maybe.
And we had to take a look at the average age of death, the average amount of kids, the survival rate of the kids. We had the family structure, this, that. And then we had to do that for each different community. One community had an average of 1.5 kids, but their survival rate was 99%. One was the Mayan community, where they had like a 44% survival rate. And the average amount of kids was like 14 here, and the average was here 1.5. The average age of the first pregnancy was 13 here, and it was 31 here. There's all these things. Then we had to do an assessment like this. And then I had to write papers on different people that I knew and talk about their different, like, their things. So it's weird when you think about that kind of stuff, but it's super interesting to me, on somebody who's studied, like, okay, how did Lee Kemp, previously Darnell and Danny, become one of the best wrestlers of all time? And then eventually a successful businessman. So I don't know. It trips me out on that front. And it's interesting to hear, like, you know, the backstories like that. And that's a rare thing. How you go from adoption to foster care to, you know, new family to becoming somebody that sets world records and makes statements. That's a rare thing. And I can see why you go do motivational speeches and that kind of thing, because that's a crazy cool story. And we haven't even gotten into the business side of things, so that's a little debriefing on the life of Lee Kemp. You know, had the family. I don't know how much you want to get into the family side of things and the rise and falls of the business, but what happens after you leave the wrestling world? Where do you go, and what does that look like?
Well, for me, you touched on it a little bit, you know. For me, the way my thought process was, I just knew I was going to be an Olympic champion. If anybody was going to be an Olympic champion, it was going to be me. I was going to be an Olympic champion, just like Dan Gable. And it didn't happen in 80, and I decided I was going to stay for 4 more years and be an Olympic champion. That was my goal, and I came up short. I didn't make the Olympic team. So I was frustrated. I was upset. I left wrestling. Just abrupt, just left wrestling, just left. Mm-hmm. And I, during that time period from 80 to 84, I went to graduate school, got an MBA because I just knew that, you know, I just knew that I needed something more than just wrestling because it was just taken away.
Where did you go to graduate school?
In University of Wisconsin. I stayed there. While I was training, I just felt like I needed to do something else other than just wrestle because wrestling wasn't a for sure thing anymore. And because of that, my focus had changed. No excuses. I got beat. No excuses, but it was just different. It was like trying to hang on to something. And when I competed through 84, I was one of the oldest guys to be competing at 27. I was
crazy when you said Gable retired at 23. That's wild to me. I mean, that's when I graduated college, 23.
So. And I was made to feel old. Sports Illustrated did an article about me and Greg Gibson as the article. He was another black wrestler. The article was the golden oldies, and I was 27.
At 27,
and Greg was 29. Man.
They're like they're about to retire.
You know, so I just felt like I was just hanging on, and it just wasn't the same. And then we got news that the Russians were going to boycott the LA Games. So the whole idea for me was to just know I was the best in the world. You know, this sounds corny, but you know, I really didn't care about the medal. Really, I just wanted to know. You know, I wanted the medal, of course, but I just wanted to know I was the best in the world. But to know that the Russians weren't coming, and then their allied nations, you know, those are all the tough nations in wrestling: Bulgaria, Romania, you know, all those communists back then, the communist bloc countries, they were boycotting along with Russia, just like in 80. Our allied nations boycotted going to Moscow, you know, Japan and all the Western Hemisphere countries. So that made it hard to train, knowing that we were, you know, it was just, then it was just going to get a medal. Again, I wish I would have made the team and got my gold medal too. I'm not trying to downplay or belittle the people that won their medals in 1984, because I wish I was there and I wish I could have performed and got my medal too. But it just wasn't the same. When you're training every day at practice to be the best in the world, and now you know the best in the world is not going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's I don't know.
I get that 100%. And so then you decide to go into the business world, completely shy away from it.
Yeah, completely cold turkey. I was 27, and it gives you an idea what an athlete will do when he's trying to transition. A professional athlete, let's just say, when their career's done, they have to go into whatever they're going to do for work. Well, with wrestling, there was no money. There was no cushion.
Yeah, this is all for free. A life of dedication like that.
I totally get it. It's something we work with a lot of athletes, and I mean, even in big sports like the NFL, everybody thinks, oh, each NFL player is getting $20 million a year, and they're not. Like, most of them are getting the minimum paycheck, or you know, close to it,
right.
And they, you know, have a league expectancy of 3 years, you know, average of 3 years in the league. So you got to have a plan, because you're probably out of the league at age 24, 25.
And if you didn't save your money, you're in big trouble.
Yep, exactly. That's why it's huge, huge bankruptcy rate. Same with the NBA.
Oh, I'm
because
sure.
They, you know, they go out and buy Ferraris and stuff, and then they're in, you know, I do a lot of like coaching with athletes to help them build their personal brand and their business, you know, because they haven't thought about that stuff outside of when they're done, you know, because you're so focused. It's such a big goal that you're focused on. You don't have time for
I lucked out by not getting paid hardly any money for the most of my career. Mm-hmm. You're forced to hustle and forced to sell t-shirts and forced to sell tickets and have another job and coach other people and this and that. So, you know, I went for the college. Like, it's still hard not to finish whatever I'm on my plate, because you know, as a professional athlete, even on TV and everyone knows you, you know, I think I was making maybe when I first fought in the WC, I think I made 12 and 12, 12,000 to show, 12,000 to win, which is a ton of money for me at the time. And then Dana and Lorenzo Fertitta came back and gave me a $20,000 check. And it was like, oh my God, I couldn't believe
like,
it. You're
like, I made it.
Yeah, I was like, you know, however much money that was at the time, I'm like, that's $42,000. And it was like, man, that was so nice. But I was, you know, I was a world champ at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then it progressed and progressed. And luckily, you know, was able to get sponsorships and stay on top and keep improving and make a career out of it. But, I mean, I had to learn the hard way. I wasn't like world champ like some of the world champs today who can make
millions.
You know, a million, couple million bucks when they win a world championship. It's a different animal. And so I say that sarcastically, but I am grateful for having to hustle and having to understand, take my hard lessons before they're really big, hard lessons, which mm-hmm. I had quite a few, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. I wouldn't have gone to graduate school otherwise, probably. I did that because this big dream was taken away, and I was like, wow, what am I going to do now, you know? Yeah. And it took me a while to get back into the mindset of, okay, I've got to really focus on this. Because I can remember, because I was in grad school, I knew I had to still wrestle, so I wrestled in 81, 82, and then I took third in the world in 81, and I won the championship skin in 82. But going to class, so I was in between classes, I was practicing, you know, trying to stay, you know, trying to remain number one in the world at the world championship. So I was always training, going away on tours and stuff, but then going to classes. So I was like a college student who was a varsity athlete. So I knew that I knew that couldn't last, and I had to do something that was going to sustain me. So grad school was that. But
then you got into the dealership.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother step. Once I start working after, you know, I didn't make the Olympic team. I had my MBA though, so I went to work for Clairol, the hair coloring company, and that was a corporate structure.
How ironic.
I know, yeah.
Yes. You too, Jason. Your birthday boy.
You. It would have been a good brand for you for sure. Although. So that was another decision process I had to make, like what am I going to do for a living? So I took this job, and I was in this big corporation in Manhattan, actually, and I realized that there's no way. You were talking about the confidence thing, and you were talking about the confidence thing in business. I just didn't believe. I just didn't think I was going to be the rise up through the ranks and be one of the divisional VPs or of Clairol or whatever. I just didn't feel like it was going to happen. So I just didn't feel like I belonged there. And I didn't want to be involved in wrestling because I had this bad taste in my mouth. And back then, coaches didn't make any money. They were making like nothing.
Yeah, really, they're like nothing. $200 a month. Yeah.
Yeah, to coach, it was nothing. So just ironically, I got into the car business through a former Wisconsin alumnus named Rusty Restuccia. I just knew him for his nickname, Rusty. He worked for Ford Motor Company, and he ran their minority dealer development program. Rusty was a white guy, but he was just very compassionate about giving qualified minorities a chance to own and operate a business like a car dealership. So I didn't know him when I was in college, but he knew of me. He was a lot older than me. But in 1988, I went to the Seoul Olympics because I did not make the team in 84. Boycott was 80. 84, I didn't make the team. So I'm working now at Clairol. And so I was still dabbling in wrestling. I'd go to training camps. I took my vacation and I went out to the Olympic Training Center to train with the Olympic team. Like Kenny Mundy was on that team, and I worked out with him a little bit. I was still... And then I used the other part of my vacation that I had to go to Seoul, and I watched him win his gold medal and all that. And it was like, you know, I wasn't thinking that should have been my gold medal. I was just thinking, man, I just wish I could have had an opportunity maybe, you know, or something. But that didn't happen. But when I got back to my office after the vacation, I got a note in the mail. Back then, it wasn't emails back then. So it was actually a written note from Rusty. And I didn't know who he was. He said, Lee, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, I run this minority dealer training program. You'd be a good candidate. Would you like to learn more about it? And that's just how it started. So, you know, I called him on the phone. He was out, his office was in Detroit. I was in Chicago at the time. And so he introduced me to another former athlete that was a car dealer, a guy named Gil Chapman, who was from New Jersey, played football at Michigan. He was a recruited athlete, played pro ball for a while. Now he ran a car dealership. And you do see a lot of dealers' names on car dealerships, a lot of former athletes.
Mm-hmm. I know Cal, what's it, Goosey Cal? Cal Worthington. Yeah. My dog Spot. Go see Cal. I think that's a Northern California guy, but I was imprinted in my brain when I was a kid. It was on every commercial.
Well, John Elway has a bunch of dealerships. So that's what got me in the car business.
So it was Lee Kemp. You put your name
Well, it was in Forest Lake, Minnesota. And because it was a minority program, most of the black people who were in the program didn't want to go to Forest Lake, Minnesota. But, yeah. you know, I went to Wisconsin. I grew up in Chardon, Ohio. I mean, it was all white. I was okay with it. I was
You're cool, like I got this.
Yeah, I got this.
So, so I was. I just wanted a dealership, man. I wanted to start working. I had these visions of making money. And that's back what you were saying. You knew when you gave that number that may seem like a crazy number to a lot of people. It wasn't crazy to you, really. You know, when I was in the, you know, working with Clairol, I just couldn't see myself going. Because I was already working there. I knew what it at least
you
I thought
want
it
the
took.
Rat race social climb.
It just, but then to be an independent business person and where you're the boss, maybe it's just an ego thing. I wanted to be the boss. And
well, it's also, you know how hard you work. I went through that as an entrepreneur, just not wanting, I don't want someone to tell me what to do. And I want, and I want to, I don't want to have to work and collect a check for doing, you know, 8 hours work. I would want to be able to work 16 hours and then reap the benefits.
Yeah.
You know, that's a work ethic thing and a yes, I can thing. I want to get what I put in, you know. Mm-hmm. I know, Greg, you agree with that too. It's like there's something enticing about, hey, you can have this if you make it happen and knowing that I'll make it happen.
Yeah.
You know? And so not everyone has that. And we talked about it today in the gym. Like, you know, there's some people that love the comfort of coming and getting a, you know, getting a paycheck, and maybe they have aspirations outside of that. Maybe it's part of their journey. Maybe it's just like they understand life better and they're like, I just don't want to spend my time doing too much work. I want to
Yeah, maybe they're at a phase of their life, they do want to dial it back. Yeah, exactly.
But it sounds like you're like, the wrestling mentality was in you.
Well, you know, I never thought about this until this exact moment. You know, the odds of me making it in the car business was like smaller than nothing. Mm-hmm. I had no experience. I went through a dealer training program, and all of a sudden I'm going to be the dealer of this massive business.
How important was the dealer training program that they forced you to go through, or they put you through, allowed you to go through their corporate training? How important was that? In like if it's 50-50, 70-30 in comparison to once you got your feet on the ground and you sink your teeth in and realize like this isn't working and just trial by error.
I think I could have, you know, the training program, what it was is you worked in every department, so you had a chance to kind of see how the dealership worked, the structure of it worked, but to actually know how to, like, to be a sales manager in a new car department, sales manager, used car department, run the parts department, service department, to, I mean, I had a business degree and a master's, so I understood accounting a little bit, but that's different than running a business and understanding the accounting structure of an actual business where, you know, you have to, you know, make money, otherwise you're going to go out of business. You can't make payroll. I can remember there's times where we, you know, we were, weren't going to make payroll, so we took a bunch of cars to the auction and sold them, you know, like a fire sale type of thing, just to have enough cash to make payroll. I mean, it was like, so to answer your question, the program doesn't prepare you for those kind of things where you're actually sitting there trying to figure out how to survive. Every day was like, I mean, we got to sell something today. You know, the place had 14 employees. When I took it over, the place had lost millions, several million dollars each year. And Ford likes to keep points open. So when a dealer fails and they fail miserably like this place, to where they give up the land, the property, everything, Ford will buy up that piece of property, that piece of real estate, and they'll place a candidate in there. And this I'll say, I'm not saying this, you know, for any other reason other than it was just a fact. It takes an awful lot of capital to own a dealership, and the minority program was not really necessarily set up to be successful. Mm-hmm. And I think it was set up coming out of the 70s, you know, Jesse Jackson was involved in that whole process of forcing corporate America to give minorities an opportunity.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you know, and it's a affirmative action type of a program, you know, which I know a lot of people, a lot of non-minority people will find that offensive, you know, because they feel like they may have gotten passed over for something because they felt like they had to put a minority candidate in there. But the amount of capital it took to become a dealer, there
it's probably millions.
It would have been,
dollars.
It would have been, yeah, it would have been few. Well, yeah, the dealership I had, it was capitalized at almost $2 million. Mm-hmm. And what Ford did is they would underwrite the almost all but 10% of the capitalized cost, and 10% of that was a lot for me.
Yeah,
actually it was a little less than a million. It was like a million and a half. So I had to come up with $150,000 of my own mm-hmm. money, which was almost impossible. My mother gave me $5,000. That's just how. I mean, it was just, you know, my dad had passed away by then, and she was trying to help me, and so, I mean, so I scraped all that together, just so I could have an entry point into that business.
How'd you do that? You just leaned on people. I mean, that'd be a sales pitch. Were you getting private loans, or did you take partners?
I had a little bit of money saved, but as it turns out, I was living in New Jersey at the time, and don't want to embarrass the person, so I won't mention their name, but I was doing some privates with in fact, you remember The Edge? You know, that was a wrestling club, the first wrestling club that started in New Jersey. I was out there at that time. So I was still using wrestling, you know, I was making money doing and stuff like that. So The Edge, I was there doing privates. And so one of the parents there I met was a lawyer, and he had a couple kids that were wrestling. So he just, I didn't even ask him. He just went, because he told me, I told him what I was trying to do. And one day he just said, Lee, you know, how much money do you need for that? I told him, he says, man, do you have that? You know it. I said, no. He said, you know, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I'm just going to try to figure it out.
You like train your kids to wrestle at $1,000 an hour?
Yeah. Can you ask more kids,
make
please?
This happen? Yeah.
And he asked, he said, well, how much are you short? I told him, he just wrote a check to me. And I said, but for it, I can tell them now. I mean, it's supposed to be your own money, unencumbered money. You couldn't borrow it. Because obviously Ford wanted me as a partner, not somebody that they didn't know.
Right.
So I went into this crazy thing. I did pay him back, which is great.
Nice.
It wasn't successful right away. It was tough. But what I mean by they were set up to fail is that because it's a private business, first of all, they're all private businesses. They're just franchises. Just look around and think of the dealerships that you see around you. They're big. They have a lot of capital that went into them. To buy and sell those all happen outside of Ford Motor Company. When a dealership is losing so much money and it's such a crappy point that no one else wants, it just sits there and Ford wants to keep the point open. So they'll buy it and they'll put like an interim operator in there, just a Ford employee to just keep it open. Not really worrying about profits, just having a point to distribute products. Then they have this minority program, and they'll say, "Well, we'll just have a revolving door. We'll put this minority candidate in there to satisfy the affirmative action thing, and this candidate will work hard trying to make it work. And when they fail, we'll just put another candidate in there." I saw that going on throughout the whole country. There are probably a couple hundred Ford dealers at the time, black dealers, that when I was a dealer, and out of 4,000 dealers that were available, that were out there. And I mean, the store was not even set up to make money. It just wasn't. I mean, there was like three technicians when I got there. We had two salespeople. It was like maybe 8 or 9 total employees. And so I get there, I fly there, I sell my car in New York. I was working for Clairol, and I show up at the airport in Minnesota. I get picked up by one of the porters, the lot porters from the dealership, and I have my bags with me, so they drive. I didn't even have a place to live at the time. I knew I could get one when I got there. So I show up, and I drop my bags off in the office, and I walk in. I sit in the chair, and it's like, you know, it was a nice office. So I'm sitting there thinking, holy shit, what am I going to do now?
Yeah, I'm the boss.
You're like, what did I sign up for?
Walk in, no house, anything else, drop off, and you're like, well, now I'm
honest,
the boss
that,
of this
that
place.
That happens to me every day.
I'm trying to run this place. So it was all uphill from there. But
and so what are some of the hard lessons that you learned right off the bat as far as being a guy that gets thrown in? You're basically laying it all on the line at this point in an industry that's
your
very
money,
hard.
Other people's money.
Yeah. And the margins are tiny for cars, right? It's like a churning
1%. It's like the grocery business. Like 2% of sales, you're doing awesome if you're a car dealer. If you can retain as profit 2% of all your total sales,
that's net profit.
Yes.
Okay.
You're doing
wild to think about. Yeah.
You're doing an awesome job as a dealer. It's like the grocery business because of the perishable goods and stuff. But so, I mean, we learned about the accounting and financial structures of dealerships. That primarily is what the accounting, what the dealer program was. There's no way to get experience as a dealer. Like, I'm hiring sales managers that have had 20, 30 years in the car business. I'm trying to hire a sales manager, and this guy's looking at me. First of all, I'm a black guy, you know, in the car business.
Like, and what year was this? 80?
No, I took over the dealership 80. In 1991.
Oh, 91.
And like even now, think how many black people you've seen in a management role in a car dealership. Because they're all, a lot of them are family business, very right. Nepotistic type of businesses. They're family, you know, they're family owned businesses typically. You know, there's some corporations now like AutoNation and those kind of things that bought up a lot of dealerships, especially like in 2008 when the car business crashed. A lot of big auto groups bought a lot of the fledgling dealerships to have big dealer groups. But it was, you know, it just, you know, you had to make something happen quick because yeah. within a couple months, you could be losing $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a month. And Ford will come at you and say, well, unless you want to put some more money in, we're closing this point.
So in that kind of situation, when that's a high pressure situation and you're having to find these stars. And I'm learning this also in the gym business is like salespeople are super important. Oh. And you're having to go out and find other sales guys. I know you told me about a story one time about some hotshot sales guy was giving you a rough time and, you know, trying to shake you down for cash. And you're like, look, man, well, hold on one second. Go out in the other room. What was the story with that again? I mean, the business stories that I'm hearing from the car dealership, because, you know, when I talk to Lee Kemp, he's a mild-mannered, soft-spoken guy who's also a trained
killer.
Animal. Yeah. Yeah. and then I'm trying to think of this cutthroat business of the car dealership world where the margins are small and the intent, like the demand is high. Like, you know, how'd you deal with that being a mild mannered guy? I mean, that story in particular was kind of interesting to me.
Well, my personality didn't seem to fit even in wrestling. People would say to me, you don't seem like this champion type guy. You're so soft spoken.
Like,
just straight face.
And by the way,
he gets that all the time, man. Yeah. He doesn't. How would you get a hot doctor wife, and now you're running this big business? You doesn't seem like that's you, buddy.
The killer underneath.
I got the secret mouthpiece that I pull out.
Yeah,
I think it's sometimes people perform when they have to, you know. And I put myself in a situation where I had to. I can remember when I signed. You know, gave him my money. They said, okay, you're ready to give your check and you have to sign and it's gone. It's like, they look at you. Are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah.
And you're like, no, I'm not sure. In fact, I probably shouldn't be doing this. In fact, every piece of advice I got was you should not do this, but you do it anyway. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, why I thought I could be a state champion made no sense really. I don't know. It's just some, I just wanted
self-belief,
to do it.
Just yeah. Like just wanted self-belief. To do it. Which is cool because, in my opinion, from what I've learned, I mean, I get my self-confidence a little bit through what I've done, like experience as far as success goes, but most of it's from the loving, you know, supportive, above all else, like my parents having my back, whether it was a perfect, you know, perfect relationship or, you know, they were divorced when I was in kindergarten, no big deal. They were still there loving and supporting, but your foundation from 0 to 5 was pretty rocky. And then you come into this new situation, and it's cool that you were able to maintain a confidence and a drive that was a little bit, I think, inherent and instinctual and genetic, and then a lot of, you know, accomplishing as time goes on, and then some good people came into your life with your step parents or with your adopted parents and stuff like that. But, you know, it's just kind of a sign that like people can find a way to succeed. People can find a way to make stuff happen. The excuses, I mean, it'd be very easy to be the guy that went the wrong road after, you know, the turmoil of a first 5 years of life. I like the, you know, the continuous drive and confidence that came out of it. And the dealership ended up eventually making some good money, right?
I was able to turn it around and, but just to build on that the earlier point about the mindset, I just never, you know, I would come to these these crossroads where, you know, we all think about quitting sometimes, even though I won all these world championship stuff in wrestling. I mean, there's times you want to quit when I was in the car business, but I had this idea that it could succeed. And I don't know where that idea comes from, but without, I call it hope, I guess. Every story of struggle, whether it's, you know, Senator McCain, when he talks about his story of being in captivity for 5 years or more. I mean, I can't even imagine being.
Yeah. I think it was 8 years. Yeah.
Yeah. But he talks about hope. You just, when there's no hope, you're dead. Mm-hmm. When you have no hope, you're dead. You know, we can see someone with no arms and no legs, like these wrestlers or whatever, people, and they're accomplishing all these amazing things. And you wonder how they can do that. And I've talked to some of them, and they just have hope. They believe, they know they can do stuff. I saw Kyle Maynard feed himself with no arms and legs. It's just like
yeah, I know Kyle Maynard. You know Kyle Maynard?
I went to a banquet. Yeah, you've seen it. I went to a banquet he was at, and I thought someone was going to have to feed him, right? And he feeds himself. Mm-hmm. How? He just figures it out.
He had a professional. He's got no arms or legs, and he had an MMA fight.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Someone told him. He
Google
just,
that. Kyle Maynard MMA fight.
And it's just hope. It's just a belief that you can do something. And if anything, I try to instill in my kids, it's always that. And actually, when I think about it, my parents that raised me always told me that you can find a way. And that's what I heard you say that several times. Instead of saying, like, quit. I never could say I'm quitting or I can't do something. That's just, when I say, oh, I can't do it, my dad would almost say, you never say you can. He would always get on. And so around him, I could never say I can't. Mm-hmm. And so for the people listening that have kids or even yourself, that is true. You have to keep those words out of your vocabulary, because when I was in that dealership, there's no way I could have that thought go through my head, because the moment you start thinking like that, you're just not going to make it. I just always thought I could succeed. And when I was a wrestler, there was always hope. And the hope was in other people that were succeeding. There are other black dealers that were succeeding. And guess who I hung out with? Those dealers.
Yep.
Yeah.
There are always ones that weren't succeeding, because we formed an association, a minority dealer association. So we, you know, as a support group kind of, you know, so we'd go to these meetings and I'd see the ones that were not doing well, lose money, but they'd be hanging out complaining. Mm-hmm. And there'd be the ones that were succeeding. I'd be with those dealers who were succeeding. So when I was going through rough spots in the dealership, I'd call them up for help, you know. And there are times in Ford Motor Company they were trying to, you know, get rid of you, because I don't think they were really all that, they cared about the program. It really wasn't something, it was such a teeny
something
little
they had to do
something they had to do. So Fourth if you man. So if you were failing and leaving, you're gonna, they really didn't care really that much. Mm-hmm. Or they put pressure on you, you know, like, because we didn't make money right away. And I remember getting letters saying, you know, if you don't make money next month, man, you're out. You know, they didn't word it like that, but that's
pretty much.
So I knew that, man, we're not gonna make money next month.
They worded it politely.
Yeah. You know, oh, it was a nice form letter from Ford Motor Company. With then they keep all the statistics on you and all the records and pages of this and that. Your numbers are low here. Your customer status, you know, so all they're setting up all the reasons so that they got rid of you. You couldn't come back at them. They'd show you all the reasons why you weren't making it. And so we get this letter, and so basically they're telling you to just check out. You can just check out now if you want, because, you know, you're clearly not going to make it. So, and so no, I wouldn't respond to them. I called the minority dealer group, some of the key people there, and they started to lobby for me. You know, so I'd get another month extension, then I got another month extension, and then we finally start turning it around. So it was like that I'll find a way type of attitude where. You know, it's like, I'm not leaving here. You know, I was you know, I just, and my attitude changed too when I was running the dealership. You know, I'm thinking, I started getting those letters and I realized that I'm not going to have a job, man. I'm going to be out in the street. So I started looking at the employees that worked there, and they looked all pretty comfortable and everything. I said, well, you know, if I'm not going to be the only guy up here uncomfortable, you know, I'm going to impose that stress on you guys as well. If you don't like it, leave. Find somewhere else to work.
Yep.
You're going to help me make this play. And I had these managers meetings, man. I let everybody know what was going on. And, I said, you know, and they all – and the thing that I think it had going for me is the auto industry was, you know, as you can tell, my personality is not really that type of – I'm not really cut out for that industry, really. A lot of – lot of dealers are really, they're great businessmen and women, but they're hard-nosed, street smart. They're not necessarily college educated. They're just street smart people that came up as salesmen and now sales managers. And they're just these crusty old car guys, you know, that are really, really just.
Sure, some of them are very nice. Yes. We love you, Ford. You want to sponsor the podcast, yeah. You say the word.
really nice car guys. They're just, but they're results-oriented people, though.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like that because I was that way. And so I started finding people like that, like those people who are results-oriented people. And they didn't mind pressure. I noticed that, too. When I hired them, you know, you get to this point in the negotiation with pay, you know, and I'd say, okay, you want to make that much, then you have to do this for me. Now we got to start doubling our car sales, put all these parameters on it, and they just, sure, it's going to happen.
There's some guys that just have the it factor, like you bring someone on and they're just slanging cars.
Yeah, absolutely. 30 cars a month is a lot in the car business. And there's a guy named Wayne. I won't say his last name for whatever reason. Maybe it's not a good or bad thing. But Wayne was a great car salesman. And this guy could sell 30 cars a month. And every month. But he worked bell to bell every day. You know, he didn't take a day off. He had a family. He made lots of money. Made a six-figure income. But he worked for it. And then there's people that can't sell a car if you bought it for them and gave it to them and said, okay. they would talk themselves out of a car sale. Man, the guys who were all knowledgeable, who knew all the stats of every car, the horsepower, this, that, everything, they would just be talking. And this dude over here just sold five cars, you know. So I learned how to find those people, but unfortunately, you can't have a showroom full of those people. Most dealerships only have about one or two. Then you round out the rest of your salesperson. You know, you got this 30 car guy, you may have a 15, 10, 12, and then you have the people hanging around eight, which you could barely make a living there. But so you're managing those people, and that's just one department. You know, then you've got parts department, you know, you're trying to sell parts there.
That seems like a pretty big business all in all, even though you say it was a small operation. I mean, obviously, we've had some talks about this before as coming in and consulting on the gym and being in a sales position before, and eye for talent. It's the same way in the fight game, your eye for talent. Same way when you're looking for employees for your company, it's an eye for talent. And then it's approving of you know, proving yourself at that point. And that's, you know, and this thing comes full circle. You know, we could go on and on. We're already over the time when it comes to the podcast, but you know, having the chance to be introduced to Coach Kemp in a time where his kids are moving to California and it making sense for him to be here and him seeking out, just like he has in the past, the best of things. It's been awesome having him on board, just drawn to Alpha Male, to our team, and saying, hey, I want to be a part of it. And where can I fit in? I see this and I see that, and obviously the knowledge about the sport has been amazing, but the addition of the mindset, which is the most important stuff, is the key to what is making him such a valuable, you know, asset to the team. And it's valuable when you listen to this, the different ways that life takes you, the imperfect beginnings that you know, lead to a drive that makes you want to do things that are incredible that no one else has done before and stuff like that is pretty amazing. And I just get something new from Coach Kemp every day. I make sure that he says something at the end of practice and get his perspective on things. And really the reoccurring theme becomes commitment level, my commitment level. Like, Greg, you've been all in on things. You're all in on Trifecta. Lee's been all in on wrestling and all in on his business and all in on his kids and you know, myself, you know, on the same path as MMA. People forget about just the all-in mentality, and it's not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's people out there that bless their heart, and I wish it was me, that can be content with you know, with having a good, like, a nice good job and then doing some stuff on the weekend and I love that people are loving life. For me, I've had this kind of itch and drive, and I've found some familiar traits in that with Coach Lee. That's why I wanted to have him on the podcast, and you know, introduce them to you, Greg, as well, because I mean, the even the book that you have, what's the book?
It's called Winning Gold.
Yeah.
And it's 75 motivational messages, short snippets that are, you know, written by me, or just some story. Like I talk about Roger Bannister when he broke the 4-minute mile. That's all mental.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
after he broke the minute, oh,
there's like
mile,
there's like a dozens of day, high school kids that yeah. have won it. Like it took years, but still, prior to that, it was thought it was absolutely impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And once it was broken, then a lot of other senior runners broke it. But then high school kids start breaking it. You know,
yeah,
girls and boys. So
and it's just a breaking of the mindset. So, yeah. You know, we'll have you back on, Coach. You're going to be here in Sacramento. You're going to be here with the team. You're also a sponsored trifecta athlete.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And so we're only fish, though. Yeah, it's only fish. But we have to get into some other things. The family, the struggles, the kids on the horizon and doing big things. Also how you've maintained health and fitness into the ripe, wise age of 60.
61. I'll be 62 in December.
62 in December. There's more to talk about. Let's wrap it up for today.
Cool.
And reconvene. Thanks again, Coach Kemp, for being out there. I'm looking forward to that documentary coming out.
Yeah. Do we have a release date on it?
I'll get you one. I would think it'll be in conjunction with the production company, knowing when the best time to release.
But
something.
Probably next few months, maybe.
I'm hopeful. I saw the first cut, which mm-hmm. I like, but now we're going through some revisions.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, we'll put the release date when we get it in the description on the YouTube version of the podcast.
Yep. Thanks again, Coach, for being with us. And tune in next time, guys.
Thanks, guys.